it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by Room & Board, handcrafted furniture for your home at roomandboard.com. Well, today we celebrate a piece of music in the kitchen. The music is the newly expanded Red Violin Concerto, and the kitchen part is a first kitchen experience for the concerto's famous soloist, violinist Joshua Bell. Improvisational cook Sally Schneider comes up with a devilishly simple cooking technique. On the other side of the culinary coin are the ever more confounding scientific contortions coming out of restaurant kitchens. Food scientist Harold McGee helps us understand what I think of as science fiction on a plate. And as always in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your call, so you can get to us at 800-537-5252. So let's start things rolling with Jane and Michael Stern, brought to us by the Devon Cream Company, introducing their new creme fraiche in time for the holidays. The Sterns write the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine.
Lynn, you know, when the weather starts getting cool, one of the cuisines that Jane and I seek out eagerly is Hungarian food. And lucky for us, we happened to be in Cleveland fairly recently. And Cleveland is home to what we think is one of the great Hungarian restaurants in this country. It's a place that's been there since the 1960s. They recently moved to a new location, but it's still as it always was. It's a restaurant called Balaton, and it serves true home-cooked Hungarian meals to die for. The Wiener schnitzels are great, and the paprikash is spectacular. It's like really brightly spiced, just kind of luxurious. My favorite dish was something I had never eaten before, because I don't know Hungarian food all that well. It was called lesko, which is it's a length of this gorgeous smoked sausage served on top of a stew of yellow peppers, tomatoes, and onions. And then, of course, on the side, you get the nice little nokerly dumplings, or I should say, you always want potato pancakes in this place. They're hot, they're crisp, and what's great is the texture of them. They're kind of rugged textured. I mean, roughly shredded, but they have that nice kind of craggy crust, and they're served with nice chunky applesauce on the side.
I think if there's one dish that the Balaton is the most famous for, it's their Wiener Schnitzel. And
it's huge, for one thing.
We ate there at lunch, and there's like a lunch-sized portion, which I instantly poo-pooed and said, no, I want the regular portion. And
Oh, Jane, swear to God. You're my kind of woman.
Two Wiener Schnitzels, each one, which was probably 2 feet long. It was so delicious and so wonderful. And again, everything cooked from scratch. And every dish comes with that wonderful Hungarian salad, which is just such simple cucumbers sliced very thin with a little sugar and vinegar. It's just terrific.
Jane, I'm amazed that you said that you like the Wiener Schnitzel best when you didn't even mention the Dobosch-Torte. For dessert.
I don't want anyone else to know about
Jane it. Jane always wants to make sure there's some for her.
Because there was only one slice left when we got there.
I was going to ask about desserts.
And as hard as it is to find good Hungarian food, try finding good Dobosch-Torte.
You have to explain what a Dobosch-Torte is, though.
Okay. It is white, or I guess yellow cake, with just insane amounts of layering of mocha cream and a chocolate glaze on the top. It's probably got, you know, a good Dobosch-Torte, it's got to have a dozen layers. It's kind of like seven-layer cake, but finer and more Middle European. And I also, good flaky apple strudel is really, really hard to find.
Yeah.
Because usually strudel is made with like phyllo dough and it's sort of lumpy and disgusting. This was perfect. And I am Hungarian, so
Jane is always correct here.
I know this is good food. This is my soul food.
I love this. This is sort of the backlash to, shall we say, the light, fresh, beautifully arranged plate movement in the country.
It's just, I would say so.
Great. If you can see the plate, then you're not at the Balaton, because Wiener Schnitzel should be covering every square inch of architecture.
Jane, Michael, thank you.
Bye.
Stick shifts and safety belts, bucket seats have all got to go when we're driving in the car. It makes my baby seem so far. I need you here with me, not way over in a bucket seat. I need you to be here.
Gene and Michael Stern are the authors of Two for the Road. Now, the Sterns check in with us every week, but you can get their food finds anytime you want. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. You know the old movie theme? The guy sees the girl every day, pays no attention. Then one day she takes off her glasses and lets down her hair, and it's like he's never seen her before. It's love. Well, I was like that about Cortland apples this week. I mean, they've been around forever. In fact, since 1898, I looked it up. And I never paid any attention until I bought some to do baked apples. So I cored them, peeled away half their skin, put them in the baking dish, did the butter and cinnamon thing, added some water, and I covered the whole dish with foil. An hour later, I came back to find that the apples had disintegrated. I mean, they were totally flattened. They became automatic applesauce, and their skins were melting. And that tart, sweet creaminess that makes them Cortland apples, it tasted fabulous. So try Cortland applesauce. Figure 400 degrees for an hour and use spices to your heart's content. Food Authority Sally Schneider has this ease with cooking. She streamlines basic recipes, then does all these intriguing takeoffs on their themes. She gives us permission to use our imaginations. Well, appropriately, Sally's latest book is The Improvisational Cook. Hey, Sally, it's good to have you back.
Hi, Lynn. Great to be here.
So, Sally, I came across this note from you, and it said simply, close roasting. What are we talking about?
Very cryptic, because I made it up. I mean, I made up the title. I did not make up the technique, which is a fabulous one for winter. It is very simply cooking meats slowly, enclosed in a snug-fitting vessel or a foil package for quite a long time in a very low oven. It's really kind of a modern version of hearth cooking. The low oven acts like the penetrating heat of coals, and think of the tin foil as earthenware vessel.
Right, right.
And what you get are meats that are spoon tender with an incredible abundance of juices and very deeply flavored. The meat literally cooks in its own juices.
So give me some specific, you know, let's walk through this. Let's pick a cut of meat and walk us through how you do it.
Okay, well, let's take a pork shoulder, which is a really nice one. I'd get like 3 pounds of pork shoulder on or off the bone. That's it could be bigger or smaller. You don't need the exact quantities. The bottom line is rubbing the meats with salt and pepper well ahead of time to season all the way through. But you can mix your seasonings into the salt, and the salt will penetrate and carry the flavors in. So with a pork shoulder, I do, for example, ancho chili powder, cinnamon, clove, cocoa, dried oregano.
Sounds really good.
Very aromatic.
Yeah.
And I would just put the roast in, you know, a cooking vessel that will fit it pretty snugly with not too much airspace around. Then I would break apart a couple of heads of garlic and just put the whole cloves in there. Cover it tightly. You can put a piece of tin foil in between the lid and the vessel.
To really seal it.
Exactly. Or you can just wrap the whole thing in foil if you don't have the right fitting casserole. And then just cook it at a very low heat, say for a pork shoulder, 275 for 3.5 hours or so. You can then take the idea farther if you want. That's sort of the bottom line. You want more caramelized flavors and to have a really finished sauce as opposed to kind of a broth that you get with a pork shoulder, I would brown the meat, sauté some onions or shallots first, just like you would start a braise.
Right.
Throw in some liquid that would deglaze, like a little bit of red wine. White wine and honey is fabulous with the leg of lamb, along with a lot of garlic cloves and some orange zest.
Mm-hmm.
And then you just do the same thing. You cover it or seal it tightly and cook it at a very low heat.
Now, how do you know you're done?
You stick a fork in. If it falls apart, it's done. That's it. You know, it's like you can overcook it And it doesn't matter. I've known people to leave these things in the oven, and they can't. You can't seem to hurt them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another great thing. Now, the reason I love these, Lynn, is because they make fabulous leftovers. In fact, I often do the pork shoulder just for the leftovers if I don't have a crowd of people to feed. They keep in the fridge for 5 or 6 days, or you can freeze them for a couple of months. All you do is take some of the juices, warm a chunk of the meat up in a saucepan with a lid, and when it gets warm enough, it will shred. And those shredded meats with the juices are fabulous rolled into tortillas for tacos. They make an instant ragu-like sauce for pasta or polenta. I once had some leftover cornmeal pancake batter left over, and I made some cornmeal pancakes, put a blop of sour cream, and then some of the shredded pork
on top. I'm sorry. I am salivating.
We almost died.
I can just picture the sweet, fresh corn pancakes with this on top of it and then sour cream.
Exactly. Exactly. And if you don't happen to want to make pancakes, think of a nice piece of grilled bread rubbed with garlic or even some crushed new potatoes or beans or something like that. I mean, I can go on and on and on.
Yeah, but I see what you're saying. It's a great idea. And I'm just picturing a buffet table with a big bowl of this. You know, you throw some fresh greens on it or whatever. And next to it, you have, you know, in the dead of winter, a pot of polenta or just a big
thing.
A thing of couscous or rice or whatever.
A pan of cornbread.
Yeah. And you could, everybody just takes a hunk and then spoon some of it over.
Exactly.
Okay, Sally, this is a dynamite idea. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Sally Schneider is author of The Improvisational Cook. Well, she left us with a recipe for that close roasted pork with ancho, cinnamon, and cocoa. You can find it on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to check out all the other stuff that's up there. Newsletters, podcasts, including our latest holiday podcast inspired by our book, How to Eat Supper. You're going to find it all at splendidtable.org. And also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Coming up, cooking with violinist Joshua Bell and the chef as mad scientist. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. The Splendid Table is supported by Room & Board Home Furnishings, where they believe in furniture designed for a lifetime. You can find handcrafted American-made furniture and accessories for every room in your home at roomandboard.com. You might remember the movie The Red Violin. It was the story of a unique violin created by a master craftsman in Italy in the 1600s. It had a sound like no other. The story follows the instrument through 4 centuries as it becomes a mystery and a legend. Well, Joshua Bell, the violinist on the film score, won a Grammy, just one of the many awards that he's received since he started performing at 14. Well, last fall, he and the composer of the movie score debuted a new expanded Red Violin Concerto. Now, at the same time, Joshua's putting together his first home and his first kitchen. But a small detail, he didn't know how to cook.
I've always had this idea of having house concerts. I love playing in people's houses for charities or for warm-up concerts, stuff like that. Also involving food, that was my idea. Because I have a couple of friends who are chefs, and I thought the idea of having a concert in the house, have my friends come over, we play, like a salon, like the old-fashioned salon type, and then have one of my friends, a chef, or me, once you teach me how to cook, I will involve food and music. I think they go well together.
Oh, I think it'd be great. I mean, I always associate performers and musicians as being people who love good food.
Yeah, I mean, musicians and food, my friends who are non-musicians, whenever they come out with us musicians, they just can't believe how much we eat. And after a concert, there's just nothing like going out to eat with friends after the stress of the concert. But I've always loved food. Even my parents loved food, so they brought me to, I remember my first tour in Europe. I was 14. My parents came along with me, and we went to several great, 3-star Michelin restaurants. And I started to really understand you know, great food at an early age, and so I still, it's one of my biggest hobbies.
Well, I was thinking, because the Red Violin Concerto is out, and the Red Violin begins, if I'm remembering correctly, in the 1600s in Italy.
That's true. It does. The story begins with a violin maker from that time, sort of a Stradivarius lookalike copy,
yeah.
Inspired by Stradivarius. I think this is a fictitious character, but it's around that time. My violin was made in 1713 by Stradivarius. The film takes place sort of around that time, maybe the end of the 17th century. Mm-hmm. So what did you have in mind?
Well, this is what I was thinking. Why not do a pasta that might have, that did come out of a century before that, but would still have been eaten? And the other part of it is, this is a pasta that if you decide you want to make it for friends, they will never have had anything like it, because it's about how people ate at that time.
I have actually no idea how people ate at that time in Italy.
Just really very basic. I do a 45-minute lecture on this, so we're going to do the short version.
Okay.
The short version is that at that time, the tomato hadn't taken hold.
That's okay. Amazing.
If you had any money, you used sugar, because sugar was extremely expensive.
Hmm.
Sugar would appear in dishes from the beginning of the meal to the end.
Interesting.
Things were sweet and savory. So what we're doing is, it's a tagliatelle with caramelized orange and almonds.
Hmm.
What we're going to start out with is we're going to melt the equivalent of a bar of butter, okay,
uh-huh,
in this big skillet.
What happened to olive oil?
Well, olive oil, believe it or not, could be used, but this was a dish of the very wealthy.
Okay.
And if you had butter, that meant you had enough land to raise cows.
Oh.
And butter was a sign of immense wealth.
Hmm.
The other part of it was that much of Italy was fat poor in those days. I mean, pig fat was what most people could afford. So we've got some
I don't want to show off, but I guess we'll still use butter. It's okay.
Yeah. Yeah. But if you wanted to do, believe it or not, olive oil, mild olive oil would work with this. And you'll see what
okay.
I mean. Now, this is what I want you to do. Take this and put it in the pan. This is about the equivalent of a bar of butter.
That's a lot of butter.
Yeah, I know. But this is one of those things you're going to eat only occasionally. Now, let me ask you something. I live next door to a violinist, and I know she's very careful of her hands.
Yes.
So we want to keep you away from knives.
I try to stay away from knives as much as possible.
We don't need the knives.
And from cleaning up plates after meals.
What a great way to get out of cleanup. Now I know. I just have to take up an instrument. We're going to light this. There we go. And what we're going to do is melt this butter with a little bit of orange juice. Let me explain the procedure.
Okay.
We're going to do. We're going to make a caramel, but it's going to become savory with a lot of black pepper.
Okay.
So the play of flavor you've got here is melted butter simmered with orange juice until it caramelizes and sugar is in there.
Okay.
Then a lot of black pepper, a lot of the rind of the orange, which has that bitter but aromatic quality.
Mm-hmm.
So that's balancing against the sweet and the orange. And then finally, the pasta is tossed in with that. But the topping is the really interesting part, because this topping exists on pastas historically from the 1400s well into the end of the 1600s. Equal parts of cheese, sugar, cinnamon, and almonds. Well, a lot of cinnamon, but not a cup. And it's so interesting. You make this pasta, people say, I'm never going to eat it. And they usually end up loving it.
Hmm.
Josh, I want you to stir the
butter. Okay, that I can do.
I'm going to add about a quarter of a cup of orange juice. All right. And we're going to add just about a quarter of a cup of sugar. All right, let's start that melting, and then we're going to add more.
Do I stir this?
Just stir it.
Everything
up? Stir it together. Good. Yeah, we're adding a bit more sugar.
Oh, that's a lot of sugar.
Yeah, I know.
Wow.
It's a strange recipe. And I'm adding a bit more of the juice, too, to keep that diluted. There you go.
That's the juice. That's the
orange juice. That's just orange juice.
You'll put some rind in there as well?
We're going to do it in a minute. So you've got all of that orange rind right there.
Mm.
You're basically making a caramel.
Right.
But you're making a very sexy caramel.
This would be, you could put this over ice cream.
That's right. Exactly. Mm. You could put it over panna cotta.
It's still hard for me to imagine Italian cooking without any tomatoes at all. But I guess it came over from North America.
This is the interesting thing. It didn't get adopted with any kind of enthusiasm until the beginning of the 1700s.
Hmm.
And you know the first recorded pasta recipe with tomatoes? 1837.
Amazing.
Okay, look, it's bubbling.
Okay.
All right, now, do you see how the bubbles are getting glossy?
I love the smell of the orange.
Oh, isn't it fabulous? I'm going to give you a little bit more of the orange there, okay? You see how the bubbles are shiny now?
Yeah.
And they're getting bigger? That means that most of the liquid has evaporated and you are boiling pure sugar.
Uh-huh.
And that means that you have extremely concentrated orange flavor. And that's what you want.
Okay.
Now you can stop stirring.
Okay.
Start grating pepper. All right? I'll stir. There we go. You can let this go for a few moments. We want a lot of black pepper.
Yeah? Okay.
Do you like spice?
Sure, I do. Of course. And I'm putting in what feels like a lot of pepper.
You're putting in a lot of black pepper.
I'm not a big pepper user like a...
Okay.
But I like it. What about salt? You don't...
We can put salt in now. We can put it in later. Here.
Okay.
But it's the perfect time to salt the pasta water.
Well, I'm such a novice that I don't even know about salting the pasta water.
You're about to be shocked.
I vaguely have
Take the mitt.
Seen that.
You're going to lift the lid.
Okay.
And now... you have there about a cup of salt, and I'd like you to put about a third of it in that pot.
A third of this?
In the pot, yeah. Yeah,
wow.
It should...
How do I do that?
Just pour. Go for it. And you can't really make a mistake. That's it. Don't be timid. A little bit more.
All right.
Little bit more.
Isn't that lethal?
No. Okay. Good. Stop.
Okay.
The thing about pasta... Now, don't worry, you're not going to have a heart attack, I promise, because not all of that's going to end up in your body.
Okay.
Now, we want to just let that get up to a good boil. The thing about pasta is that in Italy, the pasta has flavor.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to season your pasta as though you were seasoning a steak or a piece of fish or a dish of greens. And you put a lot more salt in the pasta water than you think you have to have.
Hmm.
Okay, now the pasta.
Am I putting all of this in?
Yeah, you're putting everything in. That's great. Good. There you go. All right, now what we've got here is... the sauce.
It looks beautiful.
Yeah, and the bubbles.
Is it burning yet?
No, it's not burning yet. And the way you know it's getting ready is if you pull that wooden spatula across the pan, it leaves an open, like a river behind it, in a sense that it leaves this open area. And that tells you that the sauce has gotten thick enough.
Right.
And now what we're going to do is add, I've got the zest of 3 big oranges in here, and I'm going to add all but a third of it. And they're going to almost fry in there. And then, you notice how this is turning golden?
Mm-hmm.
You see it's getting caramelized?
Yeah, absolutely.
I want you to pour now. Just
orange
pour.
Juice.
Yes, stand back, because now it's going to spatter a little. Pour.
How much? Tell me.
Stop.
All right.
And now give it a stir. And pull it right off the heat. Good. You got it. You did it. Okay, it's done. We're going to finish off the dish with the pasta and the topping. But it's done. And the pasta's done.
All right.
Okay. You want to drain most of the water off.
Okay.
See? And now it goes right into the pan with the sauce. We're going to just toss this together. And I'm going to get the heat on. Because I actually want to almost sauté it. Oh, there we are. What I want to do now is to throw in some of that orange rind. And it gives it a nice... tart flavor.
Mm.
Here, sprinkle a bit more of this Parmigiano. We're putting Parmigiano right on the pasta. And now the amazing part, we're going to put almost an equal amount of sugar on it. More black pepper.
Okay.
And now these almonds. All right.
Okay.
That's good. Yeah, I can do a tad
almonds.
More. And now could you hand me that cinnamon? This, by the way, is fabulous cinnamon.
Wow.
So let's taste it.
Okay.
Let's taste it. See what you think. And be honest. What do you think?
I've never had anything like that. That's so good.
You like it?
Mm.
Oh, I'm so glad. Whew.
This is an amazing dish.
So this is what... We know what the period sounded like with the violin, but now we know what the period tasted like as well. I think we can stop eating from the serving dish now. Maybe we should get bowls.
Oh, that sounds like a good... Okay. There are a few of others in the kitchen that might be jealous of us.
Josh,
right,
thanks.
Thank you very much. This is a lot of fun.
Joshua Bell's CD is The Red Violin Concerto, composed by John Corigliano. Special thanks to Andrew Solomon and John Hobbick for the loan of their New York kitchen. Now that recipe, tagliatelle with caramelized oranges and almonds, can be found on the website, splendidtable.org. New foods coming out of restaurant kitchens. Odd, undreamt up dishes. The chef is becoming a chemist and a performance artist. It's all about the new food science that is changing cooking methods in so many of the world's top eateries. Some call it molecular gastronomy. Some call it science fiction on a plate. Well, I'd like to know how one of our preeminent food scientists sees this phenomenon. Harold McGee is author of On Food and Cooking, and he's been tracking the new food science. Harold, welcome.
Thanks, Lynn.
Harold, this movement, for lack of a better term, in what's happening in high-end restaurant kitchens, this sort of new science, can you describe what it is?
Well, the way I'd like to think of it is that it's experimental cooking. It's trying to make things that have never been made before and to give experiences that have never been had before in a restaurant. So you know how in a typical French or Italian or even California cuisine restaurant, you work with a certain set of ingredients that are determined by tradition and by what's available in the market and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And your customers have a sense of what it is you're going to make for them, a pasta dish or a roast or whatever, and they have expectations. And your job as a chef is to fulfill those expectations and maybe exceed them. But still, you're working within a framework where you all kind of understand what the object is. In the case of experimental cooking, the aim is very different. It is to forget about traditions, forget about expectations, and try to give the diner an experience that he or she has never had before in order to surprise them, delight them, get them to pay more attention to the act of eating and the kind of pleasure that you can get from it, which sometimes you do sort of forget about if you're having a pasta dish for the 80th time. Maybe mm-hmm. you don't quite pay as much attention to how wonderful it is.
Could you give us an example to illustrate what you're talking about?
Well, yes, there's a wonderful palate cleanser that Heston Blumenthal in England makes. Which really gets the meal off to a bang and makes you realize you're not in the usual kind of restaurant. And that is, it's a little meringue made just from whipped egg whites and a little bit of lime juice, a little bit of vodka, and a little bit of green tea, all sort of cleansing, refreshing sorts of flavors. He mixes those together into a mousse and then plops the mousse into a vat of liquid nitrogen, which is tableside and which bubbles like a cauldron. You know, it's like a
right.
scene out of a Walt Disney movie.
Right.
They pull it out of the liquid nitrogen and it's kind of dripping. The liquid nitrogen drips off and they hand it to you and say, go ahead and pop it in your mouth. And you think, uh-oh, this is going to be crazy. And the wonderful thing is you pop it in your mouth. It is extremely cold. It has all those refreshing flavors. And so it really is a kind of shock to the system, but refreshing and wonderful. And then on top of that, because it's so cold and because your breath is so full of warm moisture, you end up shooting these jets of water vapor out of your nose, out of the corners of your mouth, and it really does look like a scene out of a cartoon. So your palate is cleansed, but your brain is refreshed as well. You just start laughing. You can't help laughing, and you realize, okay, this is going to be a different kind of meal.
What do you think is driving this? Because I realize this kind of experience is happening in a lot of places. I know there's a restaurant in Chicago. A friend of mine went. I think it was Moto, where they
yes.
sat down and they said, we have to apologize, but we don't have your menu ready yet because the menu is printed on an edible paper that's quite delicious. So you look at your menu and then you can nibble on it while you're waiting for your food to come. What's driving this? What's behind this?
Well, I think different chefs are doing it with different motives. Some of them are primarily interested in novelty, that is, just doing something fun. And I think Moto is a place that's where I would say that's really the driving force, is exploring new possibilities and giving the diner a good time. So it really verges on theater. you know, mm-hmm. having mm-hmm. An experience rather than being nourished. But then on the other hand, there are, I think, people who are thinking much more about the possibilities inherent in the act of eating that have not been explored in the past and that may actually result in a kind of evolution of cooking and eating into something more interesting than it is for most people now. Which is a long way of saying that people are beginning now to construct experiences in the restaurant that are trying to draw on the diner's own memories and feelings and understanding of things in order to just give some depth to the experience that it doesn't ordinarily have when you go to your favorite local spot.
Have you got a for instance up your sleeve with something like this?
Yes, I do. And again, it's Heston Blumenthal in England.
He has the Fat Duck. The restaurant is called the Fat Duck.
Yeah. That's right, yeah. And there are, I'd say, a half dozen restaurants in the world that are doing things along these lines. But he's pushed it, in my experience, the furthest so far. So he has a dish called Sounds of the Sea, which is meant to really evoke being seaside, being on the beach, with all the sensory experience that entails. So it's various pieces of seafood and seaweed underneath a layer of foam that is meant to remind you of the waves and the foam mm-hmm. that's left on the sand after the waves. And the foam is made with some of these novel ingredients that chefs are working with these days. Underneath the foam is a layer of what looks like sand, but it's edible sand, and it's been made from a very complicated mixture of breadcrumbs, of tiny little fish that have been fried and then broken up, little bits of dried seaweed, and then, an industrial ingredient that's very good at absorbing flavors and oils in particular without seeming oily.
Uh-huh.
So it's a way of getting a very intense flavor in something that looks as though it's going to have no flavor at all. And then on top of that, you're also given an iPod, and you put the buds in your ear, and what you hear is the sound of the ocean. So while you're eating the sea, you're hearing the sounds of the sea. And then as a last touch, because when you're by the seaside, there's often a gentle breeze blowing that sort of smells of the ocean.
Right.
He sets up a fan in the corner of the room, and he paints the blades of the fan with a perfume that was especially designed for him to remind you of the smell of the ocean. And that wafts gently across the table as you eat.
It's the art of experience.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, it's really something.
And it sure is.
And I think you can react in two different ways. One is to just kind of lose yourself in it and feel, wow, this is amazing. The other is to feel a little bit, it can feel a little bit staged. I think finding the balance between evocation and staging is going to be the trick for this kind of thing.
Harold, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Lynn. Thank you.
Food scientist Harold McGee has been tracking the evolution of science in the restaurant kitchen. He's author of On Food and Cooking, The Science and Lore of the Kitchen. Well, it's time for this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question is, what are freegans? We're going to have that answer in a moment, and we'll be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is supported by Room & Board Home Furnishings, where they believe in furniture designed for a lifetime. You can find handcrafted American-made furniture and accessories for every room in your home at roomandboard.com. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what are freegans? Well, to quote the LA Times, freegans are a growing subculture that has opted out of capitalism
by cutting spending habits and living off of consumer waste. Well, part of this is eating, often very well, from what gets thrown away and what you can forage or grow. Now, this isn't garbage as most of us think of it. It's food, good, fresh, and clean. It's a backlash of consumerism. Evidently, freeganism started in the 80s with the environmental justice and anti-globalization movements. Now, the first instinct is to literally turn up our collective noses at the idea of dumpster diving. But I wonder if we were to really look at what food stores have to toss or what's left at the end of a farmer's market day, I wonder how we might end up seeing freegans. Okay, let's open up those lines to the phones. Brought to you this week by Palm Wonderful, 100% authentic pomegranate juice at palmwonderful.com. The number is 800-537-5252. Let's see who has been waiting patiently. We have Juliet calling from Nathrop. Is it Nathrop, Colorado?
Right. And we live at 8,500 feet.
Oh, baking must just be a joy.
Tis not. One of the reasons why I'm calling you, and I've almost given up trying to make cakes at all, but I do love to make pies.
Yeah.
And the reason that I called you was about meringue. My husband's favorite is lemon meringue pie, and
right.
So I make what's called never-fail meringue, and it includes a tableful of cornstarch,
right.
Two tablespoons of cold water, and then you add boiling water to it, kind of cook it until it's thick.
This sounds like a classic recipe from the Colorado Extension Service.
It may be. I don't remember.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. I should explain, by the way, we lived in Denver for a period of time, and I ran a cooking school.
Oh, really?
And I brought a bunch of recipes from the East Coast. So
oh.
The conversion to high altitude, even though Denver's 5,000 feet, you're much further above that. But I am familiar with the problem.
Well, that's wonderful. I use the 3 egg whites and usually cut the sugar down to about 5 tablespoons.
Right.
And when it comes out of the oven, it's wonderful. But as it cools, the little droplets of sugar come to the top, and then it sort of elongates. You can't cut it because you can't get a knife through it, and it gradually liquefies
mm-hmm.
all that. And I've seen them in the shops, and they're just beautiful, the meringues, but not mine. So
I'm trying to think how to help you with this, because what temperature are you baking it at?
I'm usually at 350.
Maybe you should take it further. I mean, first of all, one of the big factors with meringue failing is humidity. But you don't have humidity in Colorado.
No, that's not
the problem. The other thing is that the basic premise about high-altitude baking is that there's less air pressure, so liquids evaporate more easily.
I see.
And I think what's liquefying, there may be, the actual boiling water thing. How much boiling water are you adding?
It's half a cup.
I have an idea. This is what I would like you to try. I'm not saying it's going to guarantee work, but I think that's too much moisture in the egg whites.
I see.
I think that's three egg whites, a half a cup of water plus 2 tablespoons, right?
Yes.
I would do this. For every 3 egg whites, I would do a tablespoon of cornstarch, about 2 or 3 tablespoons of water, to stir in and get that cornstarch
uh-huh.
dissolved. I would beat that into the egg whites with the most another tablespoon of water. And then for every egg white, figure 2 tablespoons of sugar. Don't
okay.
cut back on the sugar because it's an important part of the meringue. And make sure when you're beating it, that your bowl is dry, that there's no grease present in any way, shape, or form, because that will keep the egg whites from rising properly and forming the air chambers. And then try the same recipe. I'm talking now about a controlled scientific test here. If it still reacts with that beating and throwing off the liquid, then what I would do is raise the temperature up another 25 to 50 degrees.
Okay.
Okay? And see if that helps you.
Okay.
Okay? I wish I could tell you there's an absolute foolproof way of doing this, but
my experience with this kind of thing is some of it is just trial and error, but I just think there's too much moisture in those egg whites.
Okay. Thank you so much, Lynn.
And I must say, I can imagine the cakes may not be great, but the views have got to be fabulous at 8,000 feet.
Yes, we live between two 14,000-foot peaks and right in the little valley there.
Oh, heaven. Hey, thanks for a good question.
Thank you, Lynn.
You take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Call us. 800-537-5252. We have Caroline calling from Tallahassee. What do you want to talk about?
Well, here's my question. We had some friends when I was a child who were from Lebanon, and they made a delicacy called kibbeh beef.
Oh, yeah.
Which I understand was traditionally done with lamb, but they made it with ground beef.
Uh-huh.
And all I knew, because I was probably about 9 or 10 at the time, all I knew was that it was ground beef, bulgur wheat, wrapped in phyllo dough, and I'm guessing it was baked. And that's all I know, but I know that I loved that, and I just wondered if you had a recipe.
I don't know that I've got – now, I've never heard of it wrapped in phyllo, but by the way, you know, this is a case of everybody does – Kibbeh is to Lebanon and Syria, to much of the Middle East, what – I'm just trying to think.
Like maybe a meatloaf?
Yeah.
Kind of?
Yeah. I mean, in the sense that everybody does it.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody has a different, you know, take. I've heard of it boiled. I've heard of it fried. It's eaten raw. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's – yeah. Well, you know, and it's done with lamb, and I'll bet you that one of the reasons they did it with beef – maybe it was just personal taste, but also – it wasn't, you know, years ago, it wasn't always very easy to get lamb everywhere.
Well, and this was in the 60s.
Oh, yeah, this would be, yeah.
You couldn't get ground lamb, I'm quite certain.
Yeah, or if you did, maybe it wasn't from the best lamb. You know, you'd have to grind it yourself or whatever. But essentially, the way you do it is this. It's bulgur wheat. You got it right.
Mm-hmm.
It's bulgur wheat and ground meat, and you want to grind it very, very fine. It's fine.
I remember that, yeah.
Yeah, you fine ground bulgur, and this is where a food processor is really handy.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd soak the bulgur, you know, to get rid of the crunchiness.
Right.
And generally, there's a couple of ways of doing that. Generally, either a half hour to 45 minutes just sitting there in very hot water, and then you squeeze it dry.
Right.
It's tender. You taste it. It's tender. You squeeze out the water. Or you just drop it in a saucepan with water to cover. You simmer it for a bit until it's tender, and then you drain it.
Mm-hmm.
Get rid of the excess moisture. And the idea would be that you would take that meat. You take some onion. Some people put mint in it. Believe it or not. But again, this was always onion, always lamb, more or less half and half, meat to bulgur.
Okay.
Salt, pepper. There's, again, a ton of ways of doing this. I mean, I've had it with pine nuts in it.
I bet that was awesome.
It was really awesome with fresh coriander in it. I've actually had it where it was cooked in yogurt or cooked in pomegranate juice.
Ugh.
I mean, if you can imagine, you can do anything. But this is what I would do. I would take half the beef, if you want to do it the way they did it.
Mm-hmm.
I'd get that bulgur so it's softened and it's drained and it's fairly dry. Put the two in the food processor with some onion. So let's say we have a half a pound of meat and an equal amount of bulgur.
Okay.
And I would, I'd want to probably have at most half of a medium onion.
Uh-huh.
I'd put a clove of garlic in there.
Yeah, I would too.
Yeah,
I
and maybe
garlic.
Some parsley.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And I do, you know, and salt and pepper. And I would just get that to the point where it's a real paste. And then, you know, have you ever worked with phyllo dough? Have you ever?
Yes, I have.
You have.
Yeah.
So you know you brush it with the butter. And,
right.
Well, what I would do is I would put it in the phyllo. I would cut squares of the phyllo. I would put some of that mixture. Don't make it too thick because you want it to cook through.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I'd wrap up that phyllo so that if it was a square of the phyllo, you could make it into triangles. You know, you just put some of the kibbeh filling and then you'd roll it over, you know, roll it over and press the edges in with a little egg to hold them together. Or you could do it where you brought the corners together so it looks like a square and it stands up like a peak. But the idea would be then that you'd want to bake it at about 400 degrees.
400.
Yeah, and I'd brush the outside with egg and maybe you could even sprinkle that with a little bit of salt if you wanted
to. That would be some kosher salt.
Yeah.
Ooh,
I mean, it would
be
a nice
delightful.
Touch, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would.
And so 375 to 400. And I think what you want to do is get it really golden brown, and the meat should really be nice and cooked by that time inside and very juicy.
Mm-hmm.
Two sources for great kibbeh recipes, mainly Claudia Roden. Her name, she did a book called The Middle Eastern Cookbook. And she's an authority on the food of the Middle East. She's dynamite. The other person is Paula Wolfert. She did a book called The Food of the Eastern Mediterranean.
Okay.
So those are two good sources for a lot of ways of eating kibbeh and making it.
Wonderful. Well,
oh, enjoy.
So much.
Enjoy.
Oh,
my mouth is watering thinking about it.
Mine is too. I can't wait. Thank you so much.
Hey, Caroline, thanks for a great question.
All righty. Bye-bye.
You take care. Bye. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Have you ever tried to open an oyster? Well, let me tell you, it is not easy, and in fact, it can be dangerous. A slip of the knife, and you will not be winning any finger puppet championships. But speaking of championships, we have an oyster champ. The United States Oyster Shucking Champion is on the phone. He is William Chopper Young. Hey, William, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So how many oysters did you shuck in how much time to win the title?
The qualifying time was 2 minutes, 20 seconds for 24 oysters. And then the men's final, I think it was 2 minutes and 12 seconds for 24 oysters. And the heads up was 2 minutes and 2 seconds for 24 oysters.
Do you practice to do this? I mean, is this what you do for a living?
We used to do a lot of shucking. We don't do it so much anymore. I'm an oysterman, so by trade. So I'm very familiar with them. And we used to shuck a lot of oysters. And I've shucked a lot of other things, sea scallops and sea clams and steamers and so forth. So shucking's always been in my schedule, you know, but not so much these years.
Do you practice for the competition?
Not really. It's like riding a bike.
Uh-huh. How many people were you up against?
There was 17 national men and 6 national women.
So these are people from all over the country who have won all kinds of local championships to come to this national championship.
Yep.
Do you, I guess I want to know, what's the trick to opening that oyster?
Well, there's a lot of tricks. There's like 4 or 5, you know, standard methods of opening oysters, and each method has its own tricks.
What one do you like?
Thin knife.
Mm-hmm.
I slip the knife into the side of them, not so much the hinge or the bill like other shuckers do, but my approach is from the side of the oyster and finesse and some strength, you know. It works for me.
From what I understand, part of the contest is it's not just a matter of opening the shell. That oyster can't be cut, but it has to be completely freed. It has to look the way it would look in a good restaurant, right?
Or better.
Or better.
Or better.
So,
you know, all the competitions have their own different judging and whatnot, but the national is known for being very, very strict on the penalties, you know, which they should be because they're sending one person, you know, only one person gets to go to represent the United States, and they want the best representation of an oyster they can get, you know, over there for the best chance to win the world. So
now, wait a minute. Hold on. So there is a world competition. Where is it and when is it?
It's in Galway, the third week of September.
Uh-huh.
This national win entitles me to go there and represent the U.S.
Wow. Do you wear something that says you're an oyster champ when you go? I mean, is there a... I mean, I'm just thinking, you know, if you were in a beauty contest, you'd have a banner. I mean, do you have something that says, I'm the American champion?
They're supposed to give me a coat. Every year they give a coat, and that's what I really wanted the most out of the whole win. I wanted to wear that jacket out of there. But
right.
they didn't have it ready this year, so they have to send it to me. But when I go next year, I'll be wearing my Evinrude shirt. Evinrude is a sponsor.
Well, William, we wish you the very best of luck, and thanks for talking with us.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you.
You take care.
Okay.
William Chopper Young is the 2007 United States Champion Oyster Shucker. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us, and remember, you can call us anytime. The number's 800-537-5252. Have a great week, and until next time, let me leave you with this thought from filmmaker Federico Fellini. He said, all art is autobiography. The pearl is the oyster's autobiography. The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and supported by Room & Board. Handcrafted furniture for your home at roomandboard.com. Now, information on nearly everything you heard here today can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. Not only will you find priceless newsletters and podcasts, you'll find information on our must-have book,
how to eat supper, recipes, stories, and opinions. Check it all out online, splendidtable.org. Also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Tables store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Our show is supported in part by Palm Wonderful, 100% authentic pomegranate juice backed by $25 million in medical research. You can learn more about the antioxidant superpower at palmwonderful.com. Palm Wonderful, trust in Palm. And by the Devon Cream Company, makers of Creme Fraiche and Double Devon Cream. Both can be used to make toppings for your holiday desserts and canapés. Available at fine specialty food stores nationwide or online at iGourmet.com. And by Gather.com, the social network with substance where people connect around their interests. You can join the conversation on cooking at Gather.com. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Andrew Schumacher and Judy Boudreau. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Jeff Harkness. Our managing producer is Sally Swift. Have a great week. Please join us next time, and thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.